The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Guy Giuffredi to talk about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. This is already episode 63. We're recording on Wednesday, September 17th at 9 p.m. This podcast is sponsored by our partners Wenger Vieli and the Economic Development Agency of the Canton of Bern. So, what are today's topics?
Yes, in the news, we'll of course start with the exit of Lakera to Checkpoint. Then we'll discuss the Swiss National Bank as a major US tech investor. And finally, we'll look at OpenAI's recently updated financial forecasts. For our deep dive, we'll explore how AI is changing the way startups are founded and built. Then we have a listener question from Sergio. What does a venture building studio actually do? And finally, we'll wrap up with the four most important transactions of the past 2 weeks.
Great, let's start with the news. This week, we saw a big acquisition in the Swiss ecosystem. The Zurich-based startup Lakera AI is being acquired by Israeli cybersecurity giant Checkpoint. The deal is said to be worth around $300 million. Lakera specializes in AI security, especially for so-called agentic AI, systems that make decisions or execute tasks autonomously. The company has developed technology that can detect more than 98% of attacks, respond in under 50 milliseconds, and support over 100 languages, according to their materials. They've also built a massive adversarial red teaming network called Gandalf, with more than 80 million attack patterns. Checkpoint plans to integrate Lakera into a global center of excellence for AI security, with Zurich as a central R&D hub. The acquisition is expected to close later this year. Guy, what new attack surfaces emerge as AI agents become increasingly autonomous? And why is this such a different playing field compared to traditional IT security?
The key issue is that we're no longer just dealing with classic vulnerabilities like open ports or malware. With agentic AI, these systems process data independently, trigger external tools, and even make and execute decisions. That creates entirely new attack surfaces, such as prompt injection or manipulating training data. And because these models learn adaptively, attacks can be extremely subtle, much harder to detect than in traditional IT security. In short, we're no longer just protecting infrastructure, we're protecting the behavior of a learning machine.
Yes, and interestingly, Zurich will now become a global R&D hub for AI security within Checkpoint. What does this mean for the Swiss deep tech scene? Does it attract talent or actually drain it?
It cuts both ways, as always. On the one hand, it's a huge signal. Another global player is building its AI security competence center in Switzerland, in Zurich. That definitely attracts more talent and strengthens the location overall. On the other hand, many highly trained AI specialists will move into large corporations, which can weaken the startup ecosystem somewhat. And of course, there's the question of Lakera's brand. They had built strong recognition in Switzerland and internationally. That might now fade with less entrepreneurial spirit visible. But overall, it's certainly positive. A $300 million exit is a fantastic outcome. It proves that the Swiss deep tech startup ecosystem is globally relevant and that an exit of this scale is possible just a few years after founding. Still, the question remains, was the exit too early? That's a topic we'll keep revisiting over the next decade as we'll see dozens more big exits. Could Lakera have grown into an independent player, maybe even a $35 billion cybersecurity exit? That's something we'll discuss in depth in our Deal of the Month episode, where Lakera will definitely be featured.
Exactly. That's a great outlook for our upcoming deal episode. We've already started researching Lakera in depth and are trying to get feedback from the founders. That will be very interesting. Let's stay in Switzerland, but move to an even bigger front. The Financial Times reported that the Swiss National Bank, usually thought of as our conservative central bank, has become one of the world's biggest tech investors. According to US filings, the SNB holds $167 billion worth of equities across more than 2,000 positions. That number feels almost unbelievably high to me. And $42 billion are invested in just five US tech giants: Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, and Nvidia. That makes the SMB one of Silicon Valley's most important investors, even though it never claimed to act like a sovereign wealth fund. The background is monetary policy. To weaken the strong franc, the SNB continuously sells francs and invests the reserves in foreign bonds and equities. Over the years, this has created a tech-heavy portfolio worth almost one-fifth of Switzerland's GDP. That's incredible. But critics warn the dependency on US tech is very high. Losses like those in 2022 and 2023 showed how quickly valuation swings can hit the books. What does it mean for a country when its central bank suddenly becomes one of the biggest tech investors in the world? What opportunities and risks do you see?
Well, US tech has been one of the most successful asset classes in recent decades, maybe even historically one of the most successful. That has supported the SNB's balance sheet and given it more room in monetary policy. But the risks are obvious. If these stocks correct sharply, Switzerland's currency reserves and financial stability are directly exposed. And it is somewhat paradoxical that a central bank, which should symbolize neutrality and stability, is massively invested in highly volatile, concentrated winners. That's striking.
Yes, some now compare the SNB with sovereign wealth funds like in Singapore or Norway. Is the SNB effectively a Swiss sovereign wealth fund? And if so, is that good or is it risky?
Well, in some ways, it does behave like a sovereign wealth fund simply because of the massive size of its global allocation. But the key difference is that the SNB doesn't invest to generate returns for citizens. It invests to conduct monetary policy, you know, to weaken the franc. And that may sound odd when talking about the Swiss National Bank, but the logic is cheaper euros and dollars may hurt our vacation purchasing power less. But for exporters, a too strong franc is toxic. A sovereign wealth fund, by contrast, can take a long-term strategic view, including private equity and venture capital. The SNB can't do that. It has to remain flexible. And if they were to change that and actively manage or outsource parts, the monetary firepower could actually weaken. So it remains a balancing act, and the debate in Switzerland will surely get louder as dependency on US tech grows, especially now, with tensions between Switzerland and the US over tariffs and also the F-35 jets we ordered, where things aren't going entirely smoothly.
Exactly. Let's now move abroad for our third news item. A few weeks ago, we already reported that OpenAI had updated its financial forecasts for investors. Now we know more. The company plans to spend almost $115 billion between 2025 and 2029. That's $80 billion more than projected back in the first quarter. On one hand, costs are rising dramatically for training, inference, data centers, and also salaries. On the other hand, capital inflows are also increasing. OpenAI has now reached a valuation of around $500 billion and has raised nearly $38 billion in the past 2 years, mainly from Microsoft, Thrive Capital, and SoftBank. A large portion is flowing into an ongoing $41 billion round, led by SoftBank with $30 billion. That would bring OpenAI's total fundraising to around $60 billion. So what do you make of these massive numbers? We're talking about sums far beyond traditional venture capital financing. Is this still venture capital at all, or are we moving into an entirely new financing universe? Project finance, debt structures, strategic deals.
It really is another world, practically another universe. Classic VC typically involves rounds of a few million dollars or francs, maybe hundreds of millions, and in recent years, sometimes even into the billions. But what we're seeing with OpenAI are financing volumes that look much more like infrastructure projects. To put it in perspective, Berlin's new airport cost under $10 billion. The UK's new mega nuclear power plant is $60 billion, still far below what we're talking about here. Telecom networks? A satellite system of Starlink covering the whole world costs something like $10 to $30 billion to build, depending on which private investment sources you trust. So it's no surprise that people are talking more about private financing and strategic industry partners. These sums are simply too big even for the largest venture capital funds. SoftBank putting $30 billion into a single round shows we're in a different league already, and the model is hybrid, a mix of classic equity investors, corporates like Microsoft, and now even financing structures that look more like those from heavy industry.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. OpenAI is projecting revenues of about $200 billion by 2030, driven mostly by ChatGPT, but at the same time, their cash burn is exploding. $8 billion this year alone, $17 billion next year. Do you think this model is sustainable at all? Or are we in a phase where investors are betting on growth at any price, whatever it takes, and pushing profitability into the distant future?
They certainly have a spectacular burn rate, and it's a massive bet. On the one hand, revenue growth is extremely strong. We have to acknowledge that. Last year, OpenAI had just under $4 billion in revenue. This year, they're projected at $13 billion, and it's expected to rise rapidly from there. That's impressive, especially considering that in 2022 and 2023, revenues were still tiny. On the other hand, the cash burn is enormous and must be watched carefully. A $17 billion burn, for context. That's more than the entire market cap of many Swiss or German index companies. This can only be sustainable if their vision comes true, if ChatGPT and related products become so deeply integrated into the economy and society that $200 billion in revenue is realistic. That would mean AI embedded everywhere. But there are huge risks. Competitors like xAI, Meta, and Google, who are all pushing hard on AGI. Then there's regulation, which could intervene. And there are also physical constraints, availability of chips, data centers, and above all, energy. For this plan to work, the world would need to build a few nuclear plants at record speed just to power those data centers. So I'd say this is a race against time. Investors are betting that OpenAI will become big enough and eventually profitable with $200 billion in revenue and possibly be the first company to achieve true superintelligence. By that, I mean AI that is actually more intelligent than humans, capable of understanding relationships and context better than we do. If that happens, then yes, the bet could pay off.
And then there's the exit path. A normal trade sale is basically impossible. So either they remain structured as they are, privately controlled, and start paying out huge dividends, but that's not really the American way. I think it's quite clear that sooner or later, they'll go public. That would surely be one of the biggest IPOs in history. I'm curious how that will play out. Also interesting is that they're branching into completely new business models. Headhunting, a ChatGPT for kids, and much more. They're really going very broad. And the question is that smart? Wouldn't it make more sense to focus completely on one or two core areas? But I already see the pattern of the world is ours, we want to be in every market. I put a big question mark on that, which is why I'm very curious to see how this develops.
Wenger and Vieli, your partner law firm for startups. Whether incorporation, financing rounds, or exit, startups face complex legal challenges. Wenger and Vieli supports founders at every stage of their company with tailored advice on corporate law, financing, tax issues, and IP protection. Wenger and Vieli, your legal advisor for startups. This podcast is supported by the Economic Development Agency of the Canton of Bern. Whether company formation or relocation to the Canton of Bern, the agency supports businesses and founders with consulting and funding offers and strengthens Bern as a business location.
Let's move to today's deep dive topic. We want to talk about something really fundamental, how AI is changing the way startups are founded and built. Andrew Chen, one of Silicon Valley's most prominent investors, recently published a much-discussed essay where he argued that AI is not just another feature or tool, but that the very way startups are built will change. It's not just about what we build, but how we build it, from product development to team setup to questions like user engagement and ethics. That's exactly what we want to discuss today.
Andrew Chen writes that AI will change how we build startups. Not just the product itself, but the processes, the organization, the methodology. What does that mean for you specifically? Which parts of a startup do you think will be turned upside down first, Max?
For me, the most exciting aspect is that many hurdles that used to cost a lot of time and resources are now dramatically reduced by AI, especially in product development. In the past, you needed a developer team of 5 to 10 people just to build a functioning prototype. Today, a founder with a few good prompts and low-code tools can build something in weeks that used to take months. That completely changes the logic of the first phase. Ideas can be tested, pivoted, and discarded much faster. But at the same time, new risks emerge. If everyone has this speed, differentiation becomes harder. And there's a danger that teams get lost in AI gimmicks instead of creating real customer value. That's why I think the core competence of startups is shifting away from "can we build it?" to "are we building the right thing and bringing it to customers?" That's a fundamental shift.
Yes, exactly. I see it the same way. And speed is one of the key points in Chen's article. AI makes everything faster, prototypes, releases, feedback loops, etc. But speed, is it still really the decisive competitive advantage? Or does speed lose importance if everyone is equally fast or can catch up extremely quickly?
Yes, I'm a bit skeptical. Speed remains important, but it's no longer the decisive advantage. If every startup can launch a new feature within weeks, then speed becomes a commodity. The real question will be, who manages to build trust and loyalty? Who truly understands their users and can build sustainable business models around that? A product that comes to market quickly but delivers no clear value will be uninstalled just as quickly. So speed is like an accelerator. It gets you somewhere fast. But whether you arrive at the right destination still depends on strategy, market understanding, and execution. I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions founders have, believing that AI speed alone is enough. And that brings us to another point. Chen warns against so-called AI wrappers, products that are essentially nothing more than a nice interface on top of an existing model without real added value. How can we distinguish between a wrapper and a truly innovative AI solution?
Yes, so a wrapper is basically just a thin layer, a thin software layer on top of an API. For example, an app that does nothing more than display ChatGPT 4 or 5 answers in a slick interface. That can work in the short term. But the entry barriers for competitors are minimal. Anyone can build something like that. And if it gets traction, you'll immediately be copied and possibly overtaken. Real innovation happens when a startup either trains its own model, brings in proprietary data sources, or anchors the AI in a workflow where it makes a decisive difference. An example could be an AI that supports doctors in cancer diagnostics because it's been trained on millions of unique medical images, something like ScanVio Medical, which we discussed last week. That's something completely different from just a generic chatbot app based on someone else's data and models. I would always check, do they have proprietary data? Are there integrations into processes that are hard to copy? And does it solve a real problem effectively? For me, those are three of the main criteria.
Mm-hmm. Let's briefly talk about teams. If AI takes over so many tasks, how will startup teams change? Which roles will become more important and which will lose relevance?
I'm convinced we'll see much smaller and leaner teams. I mean, we use a lot of AI ourselves and can do things with a small team today that used to take 5 or 6 people, where you once needed 10 developers. You might now need just a core team of 2 or 3 working with AI support. New roles will emerge, prompt engineers or AI product managers who understand how to use models effectively. At the same time, traditional roles like junior coders or many junior positions in general will be under pressure because simple tasks are being automated by AI. For founders, this means hiring will be less about headcount and more about T-shaped skills, people with deep expertise in one field plus AI competence. And leadership will also change dramatically. Leading small teams with enormous leverage requires a very different culture. You need to be more experimental, but also much more disciplined in dealing with data and feedback. Another aspect is user retention. Chen writes that many AI products have, let's say, weak retention because they deliver a wow effect at first, but no lasting stickiness. How important will customer retention be in the AI era?
Yes, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think it's the decisive factor. The risk is huge that users try an AI app a few times, are impressed, but then realize it doesn't really solve their problem sustainably. And then they churn. That's why retention has to be baked in from the start. Ironically, AI can help here. hyper-personalizing products, integrating feedback instantly, running A/B tests in real time. But founders must understand, retention doesn't happen by chance. You need a strategy to bring users back again and again. Otherwise, you're just one of thousands of AI apps that go viral once and then vanish.
Yes, and then there's the ethics question, bias, transparency, data protection. These aren't just abstract risks, they're real pitfalls. From your perspective, what are the biggest dangers here?
The biggest danger is certainly that startups ignore these issues because they don't feel regulatory pressure early on. But that can come back to bite them later if you work with AI and your models are biased. Say, because the training data is unbalanced, you can end up excluding or even harming entire user groups. Or if you feed sensitive data into a black box without regulating it properly, you'll quickly have a massive problem. That's why my appeal to founders is address ethics, bias monitoring, and data protection from the very beginning. It's much easier to build that into your DNA than to try to fix a broken model later. So if Andrew Chen is right, what will startups look like in 5 to 10 years? For me, that's the key question.
I think the most radical changes will come in industries with huge data volumes and inefficient processes, healthcare, education, finance. There, AI can create enormous value. But I'm also convinced that a lot of what we're seeing now is massively hyped and overestimated. Not every industry is ready or AI ready. And many problems can't just be solved with machine learning, even if initial results look promising. What's exciting to me is that the startup landscape will definitely become more diverse, faster, more experimental, but also much more ruthless in discarding models that don't deliver real value.
And that will make things harder for us as VCs too. Separating the wheat from the chaff will be tougher when there are so many models out there. That's definitely going to be an added challenge for us. Let's move to today's listener question. This one comes from Sergio in Will. Thanks, Sergio. He asks, what does a venture building studio actually do? That's a great question, especially given the latest news.
Yes, absolutely. Venture studios or venture building studios are essentially organizations that systematically create startups. They don't just provide money like a classic VC. They bring in their own ideas, validate them with a team, assemble the founding team, and provide infrastructure and services so the project can get off the ground and enter the market. In other words, the studio acts as co-founder, investor, and company builder, all in one? Yes, a current example is the Food Founder Studio, which just raised 1.2 million francs. Their goal is to build food tech startups emerging from research ideas. The first project is a plant-based food construct aimed at reducing the typical aftertaste of legumes. So a very concrete technical problem they want to turn into a scalable business model.
Yes, I've spoken with the founder of the Food Founders Studio. It's two guys from the industry. They go to universities, look at patents, build a story around them, and then want to develop the case. They've now brought in investors. Congratulations to them. Back when we were at Swiss Startup Factory, we had our own studio and gained some experience there too. For example, Shelter. Maybe you remember, during COVID, many offices installed phone booths. Even today, I think that's extremely useful in open offices. Especially for confidential calls, it's much better to step into a booth. In the studio, we did the market analysis, created the design, built first prototypes, and then assembled a team. For an individual founder, that would have been a huge effort. In the studio, it went much faster and more structured.
Yes, I think these examples show how different the use cases can be. Food Founders Studio does food tech. At Swiss Startup Factory, with Shelter, we developed a physical product. The common denominator, the studio brings capital, know-how, networks, and a degree of professionalism into the founding process so that ideas move out of the starting phase more quickly.
So what are the biggest advantages for founders who start out of a studio compared to classical VC or incubators? What do you think? Yes, good question. The biggest advantage is definitely that you don't have to start from zero. In a studio, you immediately have access to resource design, development, marketing, financing. And as a founder, you can fully concentrate on the product and the market instead of getting stuck with the basics. For Shelter, that was decisive. From day one, we had a clean setup to get going.
Of course, there's also a trade-off, which we have to discuss critically. In studios, founders often have much less equity. They give up significantly more upfront because the studio is a co-founder, often even a majority co-founder at the beginning, since they invest so much capital. But you also have to say the chances of success rise massively if the topic and the team are set up right. For many, it's more attractive to start this way than to own 100% of something that has a much higher chance of failing.
Yes, I always say, better to have 10% of something very successful than 100% of something that fails. So, it can definitely be worth it. Very true. Long story short, a venture building studio is a startup factory, in the best sense. It bundles capital, infrastructure, and know-how to systematically build startups. The Food Founders Studio shows that in food tech, you can quickly and efficiently turn an idea into a product. The advantage? Speed and professionalism. The disadvantage? Giving up more equity. But the chances of actually getting something on the road increase significantly if you go through a venture studio.
Maybe one more remark before we move to the deals. I recently read a report that looked in detail at venture studios and how their startups finance later rounds. In the past, getting VC funding as a venture studio startup was extremely difficult. It was mostly family offices stepping in. Today, it's fully on trend. Every year, more and more startups from venture studios are funded. Likely, better mechanisms have been developed to incentivize founders so they're really all in and don't have the not invented here problem. But it's definitely a hot topic on the rise.
Yes, exactly. Often what we see now are virtual stock plans. At the end of the day, it's about reflecting the waterfall at exit. We've discussed this often, right? And it's actually quite simple. You create a virtual share class that gets paid out first. That means founders don't necessarily need common shares. It's okay for them to have virtual shares or participation certificates that are paid out in the first or second tier. That already makes them happy. You just need to clarify how voting rights are handled at shareholder meetings. Usually, that's not a problem since most important decisions are taken at board level anyway, and the founders can be represented with voting rights on the board as needed. So I think today, with 20 years of experience with venture studios, the know-how exists to solve this properly. Let's move on to the deals of the week. In this section, we briefly cover the financing rounds and exits since our last regular episode. The last one was the deal of the month episode, so we skipped this section then. Today, we'll catch up.
Yes, in the last 2 weeks, about $65 million were invested across 14 financing rounds, and 5 exits were announced. In addition, there were some grants and loans totaling about 1 million francs.
Good, let's start with Cutis from Zurich, a success story in biotech. Cutis has successfully closed the second tranche of its Series C, raising 31 million. That brings total financing to over 125 million.
Yes, the company, Cutis, is focused on de novo skin. They're currently in a phase 3 trial with a personalized bioengineered skin transplant for severe burn victims and reconstructive surgery patients. First data from this clinical study is expected by the end of 2026.
Thank you for correcting my English, by the way. In addition to the study, Cutis is also investing in the industrialization of the world's first automated production platform for personalized skin therapies in partnership with Tecom.
Investors include the family office of Gian Maria Giuliani, a US family via Shiloh Advisors, other family offices, and the Swisspreneur Investor Collective. New investors also include various Dutch groups. Cutis has now agreed with them to build the first international production center.
Parallel to that, Cutis already markets Vitacell, a CE-certified medical device for skin repigmentation in vitiligo patients.
That positions Cutis as one of the most exciting players in Europe when it comes to regenerative skin therapies, with two products that could change global standards.
Yes, and then some fresh wind in the app market. The Swiss-US startup Bloom raised $3.4 million in a pre-seed round, led by Moonfire with participation from Y Combinator and Pioneer Fund.
Always nice to see Y Combinator. Bloom has developed a no-code platform that creates complete mobile apps, front-end, back-end, and deployment in under 2 minutes. Unlike many competitors, Bloom delivers production-ready apps instead of half-finished prototypes.
Yes, I looked into the technology. It's based on their own orchestration layer that automatically combines design, code, and infrastructure. The result? Apps that are immediately usable without months of development cycles or app store hurdles.
Maybe a quick word on the investors. Alongside the VCs, founders from Hugging Face, WhatsApp, OpenAI, and Google are on board. Bloom apparently closed the round without a pitch deck, purely based on live demos at Y Combinator's demo day.
Mm-hmm. With the capital, Bloom is expanding its team in Zurich and scaling distribution.
Yes, they're positioning themselves as a potential game changer in the massive app development market, but of course, it's still very early days.
From Bern, another exciting SaaS deal. The startup HypeD has successfully closed its seed round at 1.65 million francs. With the capital, they want to grow their team, accelerate product development, and expand across the DACH region.
Yes, HypeD was founded in 2022 by Toby Wegmüller, Pascal Solberger, and Roger Ellenberger. They focus on word-of-mouth marketing, a very old idea, but until now difficult to scale online. Their platform systematically activates satisfied customers to generate authentic recommendations, reviews, and real-time feedback. That turns word-of-mouth, which used to depend on luck, into a scalable marketing channel.
The round was led by a German investment firm. Joining were international investors such as US VC Pace, the Portuguese Core Angels, the Swiss Business Angel Club SICTIC, Gateway Ventures from Austria, and Germany's NCA.
HypeD is currently growing strongly in banking, insurance, and FMCG. On the customer side, they already count UBS, Raiffeisen, Nestle, Sanitas, Post Finance, and ImmoScout. With the new capital, they'll now build their international base. A strong step for a Bern-based startup, rethinking and scaling classic word-of-mouth marketing.
Finally, let's go early stage to Lausanne. EPFL spin-off Lemna Bio has received 150,000 francs from VentureKick. With the funding, they'll further develop their AI platform for drug discovery.
Lemna uses physics-driven AI to make molecular interactions more predictable and explainable. The goal is to identify better disease targets and design safer, more effective therapies. An approach that could significantly reduce the high failure rates in clinical trials.
With VentureKick's support, Lemna Bio now aims to launch pilot projects with pharma partners and position itself in the booming AI drug discovery market, which is expected to reach $20 billion by 2030. So, that's it for Burn Rate. I'm glad we finished. I've had a spider sitting next to me for an hour without moving, and I have a spider phobia, so I'm really glad we managed this without it moving. I kept glancing over, but it really didn't move. If you'd like to support our podcast, subscribe to our newsletter and share it in your network. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Take care and goodbye.
And if you know a good spider catcher, send Max the address.
Yes, that would be great. Take care. Ciao.